It's August 4th, 2016. Happy Single Working Women's Day. Happy U.S. Coast Guard Day. And happy, yes, IPA Day. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. Well, folks, the air is finally clearing from two straight weeks of presidential convention hoopla, and the race is getting interesting, to say the least. So today we're going to talk about some new presidential polling numbers out in PA, the significant victory in the Washington State Democratic primary primary by progressive Pramila Jayapal, Bernie's campaign to pivot to the launch of a new organizing agenda, and Trump's continues to be Trump. Oh, and so much more. We are starting to see the big pivot toward the presidential campaign in the fall, and just things are really, really heating up all the way around. So we'll get into that right off the top of the bat. So I want to remind everybody that Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, on Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work that we do with Raging Chicken. And it really does. You subscribe to the podcast, go to Podbean app. Podbean's got a great app, mobile app that, you know, I use it all the time when I'm streaming podcasts as I'm commuting back and forth to work. Make sure you leave some feedback, give us some comments. And, you know, the more you like us, the more you follow us, the more you subscribe to our podcast, the more we go up in the rankings and we get the word out to more people. So I appreciate that. Now, Raging Chicken turned five this past July. Yeah. Woo! And you can keep progressive activist media going strong by actually becoming a member for as little as $2 a month. Our 2016 membership drive is all about preparing for the next 5 years of poll no punches. Progressive media in PA, just simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. So a little housekeeping stuff before we kind of get into it. As you may notice, I've got a bit of a backlog on the brewcast. We've got some great audio from Matthew Beniak from Beniak Biotech Brews that we're getting ready to schedule time for our next episode of the brewcast. We got some cool audio of him actually on the brewing process and the bottling process. So we're going to get to that soon. I'm sorry things have been just a little chaotic, did a little family mini vacation. And of course, you know, the university that I work, right, we're preparing for a strike in the fall, right? So there's lots of stuff going on. We're also still working on some different approaches to doing some live streaming of our podcast. You recall last week, Sean and I did an in-person podcast, and we attempted to do Facebook Live, and then we streamed some stuff over Periscope on Twitter, and that was okay. It was kind of rough, as we knew it would be. I'm kind of getting out there, so we're thinking about some other options about how to do some live streaming events. So one of the things we might do over the next couple weeks is experiment with a live Google Hangout. We do our recording when Sean's in Harrisburg and I'm back at home. We do most of our recording over Google Hangouts anyways, so it might be kind of cool to do an episode that we're doing some live streaming. So I'll keep you updated on Facebook and on Twitter and that kind of stuff, but hopefully we'll get something like that. We're bringing some more people and some more voices along the way. And that what's nice about doing a live Hangout where people can join in is that we can respond to your questions and thoughts in real time. So check that out. So we're also thinking a little bit about rethinking how we do things at Raging Chicken. As many of you know, if you're listening to this podcast, some of you know, some of you've not. We started out as an online publication, and now we've launched this podcast. So we're kind of expanding what we're doing, Raging Chicken. It's exciting, but it's also stretched us a bit thin, you know. So we're going to look at some ways to bring in some new writers, some new social media organizers, and some tech folks to help build our framework for the next chapter, for the next 5 years, really. The message here is, like, you know, if you're interested in helping out, if you're interested in even pursuing an internship or writing or contributing to Raging Chicken Press or Raging Chicken Radio, drop me a line at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com. We're at that point, you know, Sean will tell you that I've said this 1,000 times, right? Ideas are good, right? But unless those ideas are matched with work or matched with labor, then, you know, it's nothing. And there's only so far that you can keep an endeavor going simply on will alone. At some point, you have to think about, you know, how do you kind of match the work that goes into something with the idea? So as much as this podcast has been awesome, and I'll tell you, you know, this is, I love doing the podcast. It's also taken some time away from things that I'm doing over at Raging Chicken Press, right? Doing some of the editing, keeping up on some of the email contributions and that kind of stuff over there. And that's just the real consequences. But, you know, it comes down to the fact there's only so much hours in a day and I can only do so much by myself. So we'll look at bringing some other people in. Anyways, enough of the housekeeping. So, so let's get to it. So welcome back, Sean. What's going on, man?
Not much. How's it hanging?
You know, it's been good. I got to spend the weekend in New York City, which I was very, very happy about. My my daughter, who's turning 5, she's basically one thing that she wanted to do more than anything else is go to New York City. So we went there. We just kind of stayed outside the city, but we went to like a Legoland place. We went to the Bronx Zoo. We went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York and stuff. So it was awesome. It was like, you know, I miss being in New York. I used to spend a lot of time there and haven't spent nearly as much time since I moved to Pennsylvania. But it was a lot of fun. But I'll tell you, it's like my head's spinning getting back into this week.
Did you catch any Pokemon out there?
I did, actually. Yeah, you know. I did. You know, my kids, my kids love that little game. You know, I like it too. You know, because I'm not the Pokemon hater. But you're right. You know, ever since you made the mention last time, it is a data hog. So I'm a little cautious. We're sitting around kind of waiting, like we're met up with my dad and my stepmom. And so we're kind of waiting for them to kind of arrive there. And we kind of, you know, catch the little Pokemon in Central Park and stuff. That was kind of fun.
Cool. I had a group of, customers the other day that were playing Pokemon Go at the bar the whole entire time as they were having their lunch and beer. They were doing a 12-hour drive from Atlantic City out to Indianapolis for a gamer convention. Mm-hmm. And they usually stop at a brewery on all their trips. So uh-huh. We decided to stop at Pizza Boy, and we actually had a pretty fun time joking around and going back and forth with each other on a dead Tuesday morning.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's
so
awesome.
It was pretty interesting talking to them, and I'm not a gamer myself, but I know like people who are. So it's a kind of like a interesting community. We had some fun at talking at the bar on certain things.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm like a perennial, gamer wannabe, right? I mean, I used to love video games growing up, and now I would love to play them, but I just never have the time. So anytime I actually try to sit and do something, like I've got 5 other things I have to do and I feel too guilty to play. So, so let me say, while I was out kind of gallivanting out there in New York and stuff, it seems like that Trump has hit a new, like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to call it. It's not like level. It's not.
It's peak crazy. And it seems like every week it's like peak crazy with this guy in campaign. I can't believe it. I honestly think I am a lot less worried about Trump than I was a couple weeks ago. I am looking to get involved with the local election and like get out the vote stuff on my time off. Uh-huh. When it gets close to November, but like this, I think last week with him going after the Gold Star family, mm-hmm. and just like going after a slain soldier and a war hero and someone who died as a war hero.
Yep.
You know, and going after starting a pissing match with that family, I think is the nail in his coffin. I think that's the step too far. And if you're finally seeing moderate Republicans or some people who were conservative Republicans when they got elected, but now they're moderates because they're not batshit crazy, are now coming out against Trump.
Yeah.
And doing it publicly on TV and in the op-eds of their local newspapers.
Yeah. And it's been, you know, I have to say, it's like, you know, you have Obama out there basically baiting them too as well. I mean, basically coming out and saying, you know, how is it that, you know, that this guy goes after a Gold Star, you know, Gold Star family, lost their son in Iraq, lost their son, and he goes after them. And he basically calls out Ryan and McConnell and like Republican leadership.
And John McCain,
of all people, hasn't kind of come out, you know, wasn't coming out against this guy. And, you know, Obama just basically poking at him. So it's like, you know, that's something to behold, especially, you know, you mentioned last week when we talked is that, you know, it's not common for presidents to kind of take such an active role in campaigning for the next for their successor. So, I mean, that's been something else.
And you know what? as we talk later on in this segment or this episode about the polling, Obama's polling at 52% in Pennsylvania. You wonder where he's polling in other places. You know, his favorable ratings. He's going out as one of the like most popular presidents in the recent history, and he can get away with campaigning for Clinton, and this is what he's going to do. And honestly, I'm glad he's doing it because I think he needs to. And, you know, that speech on Tuesday or that press conference he gave the other day was the most forceful I've heard him probably ever as a president.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And, you know, and the thing is that what it also demonstrates, you know, you mentioned those polling numbers, right? Such incredibly high polling numbers. It also shows you that that gap that between like what people actually think about the president and how the media is covering Obama. I mean, it's such a lesson in kind of traditional or kind of say mainstream media coverage, right? What they focus on, because if your focus is on the back and forth between these two sides being Republicans and Democrats, the drama that unfolds of the Republicans making all these claims about Obama, the kind of extremists claiming that, you know, he's not a citizen, all those other kinds of garbage. And that plays itself out right on, you know, on the screen. And so it could lead to this perception that, oh, this is how people actually feel about Obama. Right. But turns out, right, that, you know, people are a little bit more reasonable than what we see on the news.
Yeah, no, exactly. He's a highly popular president leaving office and he's doing this. But getting back to Trump, I can't believe that. Man, like within less than a week, within 2 or 3 days, his campaign has completely imploded and his surrogates are still going out there. Some of them are denouncing him, but you have people like Ben Carson going on TV saying, no, it's the Khan family that should be apologizing to Trump. I mean, is this bizarro world that we live in? Like, this is just absolutely insane. You have Trump's former advisor, Corey Lewandowski, just getting torn to pieces on CNN, and the hosts are just letting the guests do that. And so it seems like it's open revolt time in Trump world.
Well, I hope so. But, you know, you call it a bizarro world, but, you know, frankly, that side of the aisle has been living and cultivating that bizarro world for like decades. Right. So it's not like just, you know, in some ways, look, I separate these things out in two things. Like one, there's this thing that we could call, you know, I'm so glad people started using this word and this language to talk about Trump. They talk about Trumpism instead of Trump per se. Right, that whole idea about these kind of authoritarian tendencies within American politics, and that kind of right wing populism, right, it makes a lot of sense to me to kind of be concerned about that, because Trump or no Trump, that tendency is not going away for a while, right? Because it's been cultivated, especially for so long. Then on the other hand, you know, there's also the environment that created this guy. Right. I mean, this environment has been cultivated. And, you know, like, you know, I've said 1,000 times, you know, Trump just kind of walked in and put the suit on.
Yeah. But it's good that, like, the other day, Tuesday morning, a congressman from New York State, like middle of like the upstate area or like that tier part of the state came out against Trump in a way, saying, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. I'm putting the country above my party and voting for Clinton because I cannot have Trump become president. I was talking to a coworker and I said, you know, it's only going to be a matter of time before Charlie Dent comes out. You know, Charlie Dent's your more conservative Republican from the Lehigh Valley region. He's not like a Philadelphia Republican where he's going to be more moderate, but he's your typical rock solid conservative who is sane and who is competent and who is liked among all of his constituents. But he's not. But he is now considered a moderate because of how batshit crazy the party has gotten. But he's come out against Trump. Says, I'm not voting for neither candidate. I don't know how you can justify voting for Donald Trump with what he has said within the past, you know, 72 hours.
Yeah, you know, good for him. You know, someone like Dent, right? Who actually, you know, I remember. I actually, in the lead up to the Iraq War, right? This is going back a bit. I remember, this just shows you how short of time frame that we're actually talking about, right? Is that in the lead up to the Iraq War, Charlie Dent was kind of one of our targets. We were kind of organizing some of the anti-war stuff. And Charlie Dent was the one who was the conservative, right? You know, people were like, man, I can't believe that he's holding, you know, the seat in Lehigh Valley, right? Lehigh Valley's got, you know, it's the third largest metropolitan area in the state. And he's like this ultra conservative, like this solid conservative on the right wing and all this. And to see that he is now representing, or he's being, you know, in the relative, you know, continuum that's out there, he is now a moderate, it is astounding, But it shows you that at least he's still reasonable, right? That you can have certain kinds of principles, even if I fundamentally disagree with them, you can have certain principles that you're willing to stand by, which seems to be not the case for the bulk of the Republican majority, Republican leadership, at least.
Yeah, no, it's completely correct. And there's still a bunch of Pennsylvania Republicans who are going to support Trump no matter what. You know, and Scott Perry, Lou Barletta are two of them.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, like they're going to. Yeah, like they're going to be like representing. They're still supporting Trump, and I think Lou Barletta is my congressman, which I can't believe that.
Yeah,
now thank you. Yeah, I haven't voted up here yet in a major election. I honestly I don't know who my congressman is because I'm not even going to pay attention because they're batshit crazy to begin with.
Oh my God. Well, let me ask you this. Did you catch that whole thing with supposedly, you know, man of principles, Joe Scarborough is now he's getting on the I can't believe Trump bandwagon.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for bringing that up because I almost forgot about that with Scarborough, you know, with his hound scene this past week is. Yeah. So Tuesday morning, Mediate puts a video, puts a clip up. You know, they're like a conservative media watchdog group that's really good for like certain clips. You know, gotta give them credit. They do put out like a lot of really good clips and the full clip of to get the context of something. Mm-hmm. And Scarborough and his panel were kind of like saying, I can't believe how Trump has gotten here, you know, in questioning his mental capabilities, his mental facilities. Is he actually like sane right now at this point? Mm-hmm. Or is there something going on? And Scarborough's like, yeah, I can't believe this is happening. You know, I can't believe who's like people who like how could this happen and how could the Republicans do this, you know? And the next day he's going up like railing against Trump, like saying he has to quit about nuclear bomb three times. Why can't we just use nukes like three times in an hour? And I'm just like sitting there. I'm like, dude, you're the reason why Trump is here. You're the reason why you're partly responsible for creating Donald Trump because of the tens of millions of dollars he gave Trump in free media airtime by phoning in every other day or doing on-set interviews 3 or 4 days a week. And like, I'm like, now this guy's like, oh wow, I can't believe this happened.
Yep. Yep. I mean, it's pretty astounding. I mean, you know, here you go. And, you know, again, he had
double speak coming from our media.
Right. No, but you see, here's the competing tendencies, right? The competing tendencies are, you know, okay, on the one hand, there's the tendency to want to do journalism, like real journalism, right? We say, you know, to actually do coverage of news and people who care about this and all this. And then there's the other one that has to do surely with ratings and profits, right? And these things are kind of in competition, as we know. And, you know, I think, you know, Morning Joe, right, just like every other cable news show, really was just kind of riding high on the Trump drama. Because the ratings were there, that every time they talked about Trump, they know that the ratings were going up, and it was easy to play. But they all assumed, right, all the people who had the journalistic tendency, right, assumed, right, that, okay, this eventually is going to play itself out, then we'll get on to the real race. But that's not what was going on. I mean, Trump, that was Trump's campaign, right? And they all just played right into that. And as their, you know, advertising dollars were coming in and as their kind of ratings were going up, they just kept on feeding and feeding and feeding the animal. And, you know, again, the worst of it was in cable news, right? The best of the kind of the journalistic stuff was has been in print. But what I, you know, would encourage everybody to do is, you know, if you're going to watch cable news and that's going to be your go-to source, you know, spend some time with independent media. Because, you know, I just, you know, take right here in Pennsylvania, right? You take the Rick Smith show, right? Rick Smith show out of Harrisburg. Rick did convention coverage, right? You listen to the interviews that he did during the convention. You listen to some of the follow-up that's been going on this past week and so on. The perspective you're going to get is going to be so fundamentally different than what you're going to hear in any of the mainstream media. And that print and broadcast alike. So, you know, whether you're looking at that, whether you're looking, you know, obviously if you're listening to this is one source, but, you know, take the time to get into that stuff because these cable news outlets, especially, they're so driven by profit. And now with MSNBC basically giving up the game and kind of, fully getting in bed with the gas industry and kind of bringing on like Brian frickin' Williams of all people, right, to be the counterbalance to who? Like Chuck Todd, right? I mean, this is unbelievable to me. I mean, you know, that even quote unquote liberal cable news station is all but gone.
And one of the things that we were talking before we went on air today, I just want to give a lot of credit also to with the reporting that Vox and Ezra Klein has done in the past few weeks.
Good point.
You know, Ezra Klein, that video he put out the other day about how could you morally vote for this person? Like, pretty much, like, putting, he's like, it's not our job as journalists to be asking to be like getting ourselves involved politically with like the presidential race, but like, how can you actually be voting for this person after he said what he said about all these immigrants, the Muslims, and now the Khan family?
Yeah,
like how can, and pretty much like saying, you know what, this is you people. This is he did something where I think 3 or 4 years ago when he was as a commentator on CNN or no on MSNBC.
MSNBC, yeah.
Or working outside before he started Vox, he wouldn't normally have taken that type of position.
I think you're right. And I think that, you know what? And I think that he's gotten so much better since he moved to Vox, right? Because I couldn't stand him, to be honest with you, right? Because I thought he always came across as
very stats and data geek,
but he's like, but also self-important, right? And it seemed like he wanted to play this, you know, kind of middle of the road thing. Right?
Policy wonk guy.
Well, but he wanted to play the policy wonk, right, who was willing to stick it to the Democrats every once in a while, too, as well, to prove his, like, you know, independence or objectivity or something like that. But since he's gone to Vox and has actually really gone down that kind of, like, that data hole, so to speak, you know, really got into the policy and the wonkishness and all that kind of stuff, I think he's just gotten better. And that video, like, yeah, I mean, you know, people haven't checked that out. If I remember, I'll put a link to that in the show notes, too, as well. That was excellent. I mean, the kind of discussion that we actually need to have. So,
yeah. And when finally someone came out and did it, and he was the one to do it. And like, you know, like his organization Vox has been taking really clear strides and taking over mastering the social media game with videos. And like, you know, those videos are solely exclusive to YouTube and Facebook, while all the print stuff is going to be on their website, which
right. It
seems like they have seemed to master the sharing aspect of those videos. And it seems like those type of videos are now making an impact on the election and what younger people make, the decisions they're making.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Well, listen, we're coming up to a break. After the break, we're going to get into a little bit. I don't know if people heard about this. You know, if you've been paying attention to social media or whatever, you probably have. Bernie Sanders has just officially launched his campaign. I launched it last week to basically pivot from the presidential election campaign in terms of organizing for the future. He started basically shifted his campaign, you know, the Bernie for President campaign, into Our Revolution, this organization that will, I guess, pick up the organizing baton and kind of moving it forward following the election. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk about some really exciting news in terms of progressive candidates, particular Pramila Jayapal from out in Washington State. She's won a primary yesterday, which means that she's got a good chance of winning a seat in Congress come the fall. We'll talk a little about that, some other progressive candidates moving forward. And then we want also going to get into, there's a new Franklin and Marshall poll that was just released. And I'm going to have Sean kind of get into some of the details of that, because it's got some interesting showings about what the latest polling numbers are looking like in Pennsylvania. So we're going to get into all of that right after the break. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break with so much more.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day that the United States and Mexico signed the Mexican Farm Labor Agreement. It became known as the Bracero Program. The word bracero can be translated into one who works with his arms and refers to farm workers. This program allowed Mexican agricultural workers to enter the United States on a temporary basis. There was a shortage of labor due to the U.S. entry into World War II. Large American farm owners were clamoring for cheap labor. By 1945, more than 100,000 Mexican migrant workers were employed through bracero contracts, mostly in western and southern states. Most were farm workers, but others labored on the railroads. The program continued until 1964. More than 4.5 million individual labor contracts with Mexican workers were awarded as part of this program. Many of these workers faced exploitation and discrimination. For example, some of the workers had to subject themselves to fumigation by DDT before they could enter the United States to work. These Mexican workers were often paid less than white workers performing the same labor, and they were often cheated out of their wages. The workers were required to work long hours under often grueling conditions. Despite this exploitation, the Bracero program did have some minimal protections for pay and working conditions for those under contract. Farm owners unwilling to meet even these low standards began to hire undocumented labor to skirt the rules. Labor organizer Ernesto Galarraza wrote a book about the program called Stranger in Our Fields. In it, he recounts a worker explaining, quote, "In this camp, we have no names. We are called only by numbers." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. And of course, we deal with politics all over the progressive field. So, as I mentioned before the break, some new polling numbers that just came out from Franklin & Marshall. The Franklin & Marshall poll is, you know, one of the go-to polling organizations in the state of Pennsylvania. They do some great work. And it's got some interesting showings about what's happened after the conventions are all over and dust starts to settle and what's it look like here on the ground in Pennsylvania. So Sean, why don't you kind of walk us a little bit what some of the findings are of the poll?
Sure. So last week during the convention, a separate poll was issued where it showed Clinton opening up like a 7-9 point lead, and the convention wasn't even over yet. She didn't even speak yet. Mm-hmm. So this poll was conducted within the past week after the convention, and it looks like it shows Clinton opening up an 11-point lead with 49-38 over Trump in Pennsylvania, which is pretty significant. You know, just goes to show you what has happened over the past couple of weeks with Trump. And, you know, Christ, they probably didn't even poll the what he said about this Khan family yet. So, like, right. You just see, like, that small little window there, and this is how big that this polling has opened.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting looking at, you know, the specific questions that were asked in the poll, like everything from has the experience to be president, beliefs are closest to how you value or to about your own values, has the character and good judgment, will protect the United States against terrorism, is the most prepared to fix our economic problems, will change government policies in a ways that makes your life better. Like every single one of those questions, Clinton comes out ahead of Trump. And I thought that, you know, once you start getting into those details, that's pretty significant. So you take that 11-point lead, but then you break it down in terms of, you know, the kinds of things that that people are feeling about the campaign. It's pretty amazing. You know, Hillary's negative numbers, or I should say that, you know, when it gets on the honest and trustworthy stuff, that's her lowest showings at 33% says that, you know, that she's the most honest and trustworthy, but she still beats Trump on that. Right.
And one of the things I was going to say, one of the things I've been looking at, like I didn't really look at those questions. You know, mm-hmm. I looked at Obama's approval rating, but the second thing I usually go to after that mm-hmm. is the splits down at the bottom of the polling, seeing how like the demographic breaks out. And one of the things I find really important is that Franklin & Marshall designates their regions separately. Philadelphia is its own, and then the surrounding counties are the southeastern part of the state.
Yep.
You know, of course, Philadelphia went big for Clinton 83-7, but it went 60-20 in the southeastern region. Clinton, 60% of the voters in southeastern Pennsylvania, the five counties or the four counties around Philadelphia, 60% went for Clinton, while 20 went for Trump.
And that's huge. That is absolutely enormous.
Because like this is where you still have your moderate Republicans living in that part of Pennsylvania. And then there's a second breakout table where it's registered white voters only. And again, Philadelphia is 77% to 9, which I find shocking, considering, you know, how racism is still an issue in Philadelphia among whites.
Yep.
And then southeastern PA remains the same, 60-21%, which is, again, where he's trying to play on that white resentment vote, which is, it's certainly not happening.
No, just that it's not moving things at all for them. That's for sure.
Which in my opinion is a really good thing for. It's good to see like that people aren't buying into his rhetoric, as the media may think that a lot of people are.
Right. And I think that, you know, and at this, you know, on the one hand, when I first saw, you know, just the, you know, the top numbers there about the 11% lead, about her lead and all those kind of questions, the percentage, you know, the gap of her lead in, you know, as you're pointing out in the Southeast and so on, you know, it makes me think like, okay, you know, maybe we're actually approaching that, you know, an end to the craziness on the right wing. You know, and, you know, Pennsylvania it's a tough state for that. You've got, you know, population centers, which tend to vote Democrat, but then you've got the bulk of the counties in the state that, kind of lean Republican, you know, go back and forth, have a lot of the Reagan Republicans, that were former Democrats, all that kind of stuff. And so, well, maybe this is the end of it, but then, you know, you go down into the poll and we start looking at the U.S. Senate election. You know, McGuinty is barely out ahead of Toomey. Right at this point. Now, I should say, you know, she's out 39-38 in this poll, right, which is in the margin of error. But you still got 23% people who say that they don't know, right? So that's important. My point in that is that, you know, we saw a similar dynamic happen within the governor, the gubernatorial race here in Pennsylvania, where Tom Wolf won huge, right, statewide, but had no coattails down ticket. And that is the one thing that kind of concerns me a bit, because this is not just about the presidential election. It's also going to be about Congress.
I don't know. I don't know if it's about, I don't know if McGuinty's poll is about down ballot more than if she's just a bad candidate. In my opinion, McGuinty's a bad candidate.
No, I agree that, but I'm not disagreeing with you. My point is this, right? So my point is that, you know, a lot of times what you have voters who are coming out for a presidential election that don't normally come out in the rest of the year. And what they'll do is that, you know, 9 times out of 10, well, I don't know if it's 9 times out of 10, but they're more likely to kind of vote kind of straight line, like down, or kind of make pick and choose here and there. But there's tends to be a swing towards the, you know, the victor, right? You know, a swing in terms of, okay, if you have a margin of 40%, right, that, you know, that you're showing in the Southeast, you would expect to see some of that down ticket too as well for those people who come out and are kind of, you know, consistent Democratic voters. But that's not showing up when it comes to McGuinty.
I don't know. I think it might take some time for that to show up as the race goes deeper. I think McGuinty should be attacking Toomey and comparing Toomey to Trump with his policies, where they pretty much agree on a lot of social conservative issues. But I think people really aren't that crazy about McGuinty either.
Yeah, I think you're right.
They feel like they're just getting more of the same with either candidate. And plus, Pennsylvania has a history of ticket splitting. So maybe that could be involved too, where, you know, we have a history of like splitting up the ticket, where when I vote, I just, you know, usually just vote for all the Democrats, mm-hmm. regardless. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, cool. Well, so we'll see. We'll keep an eye on that as it moves forward. And I think that, you know, for all, you know, the polls that are all coming out right now, I like the Franklin and Marshall one, right? And I'm glad that you kind of came across this, right? So we can talk about this today for some of the dust has begun to settle a little bit, right? So, you know, those flash polls that usually come out right after the conventions usually don't amount to a hill of beans. But as we start moving more closer to Labor Day, right, once you get to Labor Day and afterwards, that's kind of traditionally the time when you start to see things, the race really being tightening, people start paying attention, and we'll come back to that poll to kind of, you know, to see what's happened, to see if we're seeing any kind of movement whatsoever.
Yeah, and also today, were also a bunch of other state polls just released within the past day or two. And it showed, like, those are the polls to be focusing on, because those are the polls that are going to determine the race with the way our electoral college is set up. And Clinton has opened up a 15-point lead over Trump in New Hampshire, which is sort of surprising because they're sort of like a holdout up in New England. And then in Michigan, Clinton has opened up a 9-point lead over Trump, 41-32%. So it seems like his Rust Belt strategy may not be working with Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and now Michigan. It seems like people are there supporting Clinton over Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll keep an eye on it. I mean, this is, you know, in some ways I'm cautiously, you know, happy about this, that we're seeing, you know, the potential, you know, the beginning of the end, you know, and frankly, I think two other indicators are important for me, right? Not just the polling, but also the fact that Trump is already now beginning to kind of lay the seeds for his own loss, right? By coming up with his little kind of conspiracy theories about the election being rigged, right? Kind of floating that stuff out there, just so he's got that in his back pocket. And then there was also questions. I mean, people probably saw this too as well. In the New York Post, they ran kind of nude pictures of Melania Trump, right? And there were rumors that these were actually released by the Trump campaign, right, by Trump himself, right, as a way to kind of shift the discussion towards something that was kind of more within his wheelhouse. But if that was true, I don't know if that was true or not. He completely derailed that possibility through, you know, the attack against the, you know, the Gold Star family. So,
and also we have, more leaks coming out of the RNC. You know, yesterday it was reported that the RNC is now opening up the possibility of what would happen if Trump were to drop out of the race, you know, right, the possibility of replacing candidates. And, you know, that little nugget got leaked out into the papers. You got to think that had to come from the RNC itself saying, hey, we're starting to look into see what happens when this guy drops out.
Yeah.
If he drops out, you're kind of like just them saying we have no confidence in Trump right now. And that's not really that's never a great thing when your party is voting on basically has a no confidence vote against the candidate.
Yeah, and, well, again, I'm happy with it.
Yeah, no, and that's the only logical place where that leak came from was the RNC itself. That had to come from Reince Priebus.
Yeah, Reince or someone close there. You know, someone who's up there, and they, you know, something like that doesn't get leaked without there being a reason for it. It's not just some random disaffected person like, you know, the media.
That's coming from someone very high up within the RNC.
Exactly. So, I mean, we have all the kind of the chaos that is going on the right. I mean, it looks like we're actually seeing the beginnings, right? And again, I'm hesitant to kind of overstate the case here, but the beginnings of what it looks like to be a long-term strategy on the Democratic side of the ticket, particularly among progressives. I mean, yesterday there was a primary out there in Washington State, and Pramila Jayapal won this primary. She won by 38%. I think the next closest candidate was down to 20, 21, something like this. And so basically she's going to be going on to the election in the fall. And it looks like she's got a pretty good shot at getting this. She is, you know, she's an immigrant rights advocate. She's been very, very popular in the state of Washington. She was one of the first candidates that Bernie Sanders came out and supported for Congress. And the fact that she won by strong double digits is a really, really good sign. And meanwhile, it looks like Zephyr Teachout in New York, she's coming up. She's actually running in a Republican district, but the indications are that she's actually got a real shot at taking that seat. And then you got Jamie Raskin, who's the odds-on favorite down in Maryland, right? Another strong progressive candidate. He's a strong favorite to win that seat. So what you see is, like, especially when Pramila Jayapal, why that's so significant is that she basically beat out, right, the incumbent Democrat in that race to be the one to win that primary. So that's really, really significant. You're starting to see that shift. And, you know, I'm highly encouraged by that.
No, one of the things that Sanders said after the convention, or one of his aides said after the convention, is that why – talking about the Green Party, and he basically said they only come out for elections every 4 years. That's not an organizing model to come around it. And he basically said the best way to do this is to run for local elections, you know, school board, your municipal elections, county elections, and state races. It seems like this Jayapal candidate, she was a hot, extremely popular state senator, where she won by a 70 to 30% margin in 2014. So it seems like she definitely has the backing of her community in a strong way. She seems like an extremely popular legislator in that area.
Absolutely. And she's been, you know, out in front in support of, you know, the Fight for 15, the support for, you know, if you ran down the ticket of kind of progressive left agendas, right, or platforms that we would kind of want to support. I mean, she's right on the money with these stuff, and she's again highly persuasive. She's engaging. She's a powerful speaker. She's a great organizer. She's got everything that I think we would want to see in that. Because, you know, John Nichols was writing about this in The Nation following her win. And she's saying, you know, this is the kind of thing that really has to change. We have to stop thinking solely about the presidential campaign, right? Paying attention every 4 years, but start to actually really grapple with the fact that if you want to have any kind of significant change in our kind of legislation and so on, that we're gonna have to change Congress. And this is a huge step forward in my mind.
Right. And what I think recently, especially locally in Pennsylvania, Democrats have come out in the off-year elections. You know, mm-hmm. in 2014, they got, you know, Wolf elected governor. Then they came out the following year and got three Democratic judges voted to the Supreme Court in an odd year election, something that would never really ever benefit the Democrats. Mm-hmm. In the state. And it seems like, you know, if you add three or four more vocally outspoken progressives to the United States House, that's a big step in itself.
Absolutely.
Like that's a huge victory in itself, because you now have three more people or four more people that are not going to stand back and be quiet about things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has a real potential to change the dynamic. I think if you look at what happened, what Elizabeth Warren has been able to do in the Senate, not just simply in terms of, you know, leading it all, but what she's been able to do with her voice and advocating for progressive positions in a very, very public way, like with Zephyr Teachout, with Pramila Jayapal, and with Jamie Raskin, they also have a similar kind of bent, right? You know, they would do the same kind of stuff. They're public advocates. So I could see them doing the same kind of thing down there in the House. And that, you know, if you use what Elizabeth Warren has been able to do in terms of how much momentum that is given, you know, to the, you know, kind of the New Deal model of the Democratic Party, it's pretty impressive. And I think that's where that can be a huge impact, even if they're not going to take the House, which they're not going to. But even if they, you know, get some significant gains, this could really help out.
I know one of the things that with Zephyr Teachout is that she really became famous a few years ago for primarying Andrew Cuomo in a race, running the Working Party's platform. And, you know, I never even heard of this lady. Really, I never really heard of her until this race. You know, you've seen her around public policy and public advocacy, but she was able to take 34% in a Democratic primary against the incumbent governor, who wasn't really well that liked. And he was trying to get Teachout to drop out until the last minute.
Yep, and we need more of that, right? We need more of that. Got to primary these folks, especially, you know, you get someone like Cuomo. I mean, Cuomo's done some decent things when it comes to, like, you know, the fracking ban and things like this, but he's horrible on education, right? He's in that same model of the DLC, Democrats. You know, he's a free trader in kind of a lot, many ways. I mean, there's lots of huge problems with Cuomo. And so, you got a big gap there on the left. Right. Those people are just like, what the hell? You know, we've lost everything. You got someone like Zephyr Teachout come along and suddenly, whoa, you know, maybe we can actually take this. And 34% of the vote, that's huge.
Yeah. No, it seems like this is only the beginning for the Sanders thing, our revolution by Bernie Sanders.
No, that's right. And so, yeah, so let's get to that. So our revolution thing, this is just kind of, yesterday. Well, last week it was the announcement, but yesterday email started showing up in people's inboxes, kind of looking to start fundraising for our revolution. I'm going to read you a little bit. Here's kind of what the top of the email says. It says, election days come and go, but the struggle for economic, social, racial, and environmental justice continues. Together, we built something special and unprecedented through our presidential campaign, and now we are going to take the next steps for our political revolution. We are building a new organization called Our Revolution. Our goal will be the same as in our campaign. We must work to transform American society by making our political and economic systems work for all of us, not just the 1%. And then it asks for contributions and goes into a little bit more about here. You know, the three points is that number one, revitalizing American democracy by bringing millions of working people into the political system, empowering the next generation of progressive leaders by inspiring, recruiting, and supporting progressive candidates, right? And elevating political consciousness by educating the public about the most pressing issues confronting our nation, and bold solutions need to address them. Again, I take this again cautiously. It's highly encouraging to see that, right? The fact that there's revitalizing American democracy, empowering the next generation of progressive leaders, and elevating political consciousness are not simply goals for this election cycle, but they are long-term goals, right? Which, you know, we've talked about this 1,000 times on this program, that is one of the things that we need. We need that kind of investment in our political infrastructure and our media infrastructure and so on. And it looks like that this is the direction that Bernie Sanders has, you know, has turned, or this is the direction that his, you know, post-campaign efforts are going to go. And that's highly encouraging. When I tell you, when I first read it, you know, of course, I'm going to be a little bit skeptical right at the get-go, just in part because of what happened with Obama, right, where Obama kind of came out and said that, you know, we've got this new organization and then basically turned it into like a fundraising tool for the Democratic Party. I don't expect Bernie Sanders to be doing that. But again, we'll be watching this really closely, but this is highly encouraging.
And you know what, but I would not have a problem if this turns into a fundraising tool for SALT to help to support progressive candidates get elected in state houses or in, you know, congressional seats around the country. I actually would encourage that. You know, I would like to see something like that happen and use this as a way to, like, you know, small dollar donation thing to start electing or get people involved in state and local politics, because that's where it's going to have to happen the most.
No, I don't disagree with you. And I that's different in my mind than becoming a fundraising arm for just the Democratic Party.
No, I would like to see this become a fundraising arm for the progressive movement and say, you know what, you want to get involved in politics? Here's a couple $1,000 for your local race or something like that. That can go a long way in helping get, you know, start cultivating your bench in state politics around the country. And frankly, I would love to see something like that in Pennsylvania, because there is no bench. You know, there's no one out there. You know, our Democratic Party has, I think, failed us in grooming candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, we've talked about this in a different form, like in a different form here, like again on this program. It's like, you know, one of the things that, you know, that is the most difficult thing to get your head around. You want to do a program like this. You want to kind of do independent media. As you know, frankly, it doesn't happen out of thin air, right? That if you actually want this stuff to succeed, you actually have to be able to fund it and make it sustainable, right? There's only so long you can go by doing this stuff on a volunteer basis or on the side basis. But we don't have, on the left, we don't have the billionaire backers that are just going to drop in a bunch of money and fund a program like this one, right? Or fund an independent kind of media infrastructure. That's just not going to happen, right? But the alternative is that we have the numbers, right? We know this is an idea, but on the left, we have not been very good about supporting those institutions and supporting those candidates and actually putting our money behind a movement, right? By actually being kind of becoming members and so on. It's not that we can't do it. It's just that we don't do it, right? For whatever reason, right? And I know that there's people that don't have a lot of money. I'm not talking about those people, but a wide swath of people who are kind of middle-class Americans, you know, working, you know, kind of making a decent income, who can spare $5, $10, $15 a month, right? What Bernie Sanders has shown us, right, is that actual model works, right? He turned that into practice. You know, the famous phrase of $27, the average contribution of $27 to this campaign, right, shows you that when people actually get behind an agenda, get behind in supporting a particular kind of candidate or platform, that this can happen. And I think that by turning immediately into this Our Revolution campaign, and by keeping that model alive, before people forget about how powerful that model has been, I agree that this can actually turn into a major fundraising apparatus to actually support those progressive candidates. You know, and they're pledging, you know, to support more than like 100 candidates that are running for public office, right? And not just like at Congress level, but actually at the state and local level.
It'll be amazing, you know, say they even get a few of those, it would be a huge victory because of the turnaround time. If you get 20 of those people elected, I would consider that a victory and something you can say, hey, in this short amount of time, we were able to get 20 or 25 people elected into office, you know, state races and stuff like that. And that's where what I like about where progressives see things and then where the National Party doesn't, where Sanders is hit this new movement saying, no, it starts at the state level.
It's got to.
We've been saying here for years. It starts on the state level, and you have to start flipping state houses around the country. And this is one of the Democratic Party let happen during Debbie Wasserman Schultz's time. She's allowed basically all these, like 2/3 of the country, to become controlled by Republican legislatures or have divided government.
Right. Yeah,
and here's it's something that's going to have to take a while to reverse.
No, that's right. And, you know, like they show that like, when people decide to run for office, right, you know, we talk about the power of incumbency. If someone is already elected to office, right, the advantage goes to them when it comes to the election time, right, regardless of party. And so if you want to run for office, if you actually want to kind of like win an election, you know, they show the general, you know, the rule of thumb, so to speak, is that you have to be prepared to run three times, right? So that first time you're most likely going to lose, right? But then you have to stay with that campaign for that next time around and then the next time around, right? That's their timeline, right? And this is why I'm excited about this organization, because it's saying, okay, yeah, we're going to back these candidates now, right? But then it's not just back, oh, they lost. Oh, shucks. We tried. No. You're going to stay with it. Right, you're going to stay with it and build for that next election and the next election. That's how you win, right? And this is not brain surgery. I mean, this is how organizers go at things. If you look at, you know, union organizing campaigns, right, is that I remember a friend of mine who was an organizer with SEIU, and she worked in healthcare, right, did organizing with healthcare. And SEIU was organizing out in Pittsburgh, right? This is guy got 10, 15 years ago now. And I remember her talking about that. Yeah. She's like, yep, they're shipping up to Pittsburgh to do some organizing. I was like, oh, there's a legit chance to win this campaign. She goes, oh, no, there's no chance of winning this campaign. I'm like, oh, so what, but they're sending you out there. She says, oh yeah, it's because they're after this, you know, 10, 15 years from now, right? Because they know that, you know, if you're going to lose this campaign, then you're just going to stay with it. And sure enough, we see right now, like the kind of activism that's going out there, going out there in Pittsburgh, right, around organizing healthcare workers and so on.
UPMC.
At UPMC, right, that's exactly where she was at. That is the product, right, of over a decade of organizing on the ground to get to that level, and they not walking away from that. We could do the same thing when it comes to our politics. That's going to be pretty impressive.
Yeah. And I, frankly, it's time that someone's done it. And hopefully, you know, hopefully this works out.
I hope so. And I want to, you know, there's a piece today, it's an opinion piece on in These Times, I should say from yesterday, by Joel Bleifuss, I think his name is. And he's talking about this new Bernie Sanders campaign, and he makes kind of a couple interesting points. And one, he says that, you know, he's pretty harsh on Sarah Silverman for her comments at the Democratic convention, saying that, you know, you people, you're being ridiculous, you know, to the Sanders people that were chanting and kind of booing and hissing and heckling and things like this. Frankly, to be honest with you, I'm sympathetic to what Sarah Silverman said, right? I thought that as much as there was the booing and the chanting and the heckling and that stuff, it did not seem like organized or it didn't seem like agenda. It just seemed like anger, right? And I get that, right? But I also kind of get where she was coming from. So this person, you know, Joel Blythe is a little bit harsh on her, but it says, you know, part of it is that these are folks that came out of a tradition of Occupy Wall Street, not people who came out of the tradition of the Democratic Party. So there's that kind of clash, which is a good point. But I want to just read a section of kind of how he closes this piece and about why this is important. Bernie Sanders' campaign about our revolution is going to be important going forward. And it gets to a lot of the themes that we've talked about on this program, about this inside-outside strategy and how do we move forward, and it kind of says it particularly well. So bear with me for a second. So this is Joel Bleifuss in These Times. This quote, Clinton clinched the nomination, but the political revolution will continue in the guise of what the Sanders campaign is branding, quote, our revolution. Under the inclusive banner, the campaign will deploy resources to more than 100 candidates running for public office this fall. And this is a quote that, quote, if we are successful, what it will mean is that the progressive message and the issues that I campaigned on will be increasingly spread throughout this country, Sanders told USA Today, explaining that our revolution will encourage grassroots activists. Quote, to get involved, give them the tools they need to win, and help them financially, Sanders said. To nurture the grassroots, our revolution will pursue a 50-state strategy, beginning with the challenge to Democratic Party leadership in many of the states that Bernie carried in the primaries and caucuses. Democratic establishment be warned. Expect Sanders supporters to run in party precinct elections from Vermont to Hawaii. Since its founding 40 years ago, In These Times has advocated an inside-outside strategy vis-a-vis electoral politics. On the outside, we raise Cain, agitate, and describe the contours of a just and more democratic future. On the inside, we promote meaningful change within the existing dominant institution. The inside game inevitably involves joining with forces with people with whom we do not always agree. The alternative to pursuing such a strategy is to cede control of the public sphere to the rich and the powerful. I thought there was such a great statement about that inside-outside strategy and positioning what Bernie Sanders is doing right within that kind of strategy. That was incredibly encouraging, and I really look forward to seeing where we're going next.
And one of the things I could see, this is going to bring a lot more people into the Democratic Party who normally would not have been in the party. And I think as the potential of changing party politics, you know, 10 or 15 years down the line. And he's not changing. He's not looking to change party politics next time around or two times around. But it's like, you know, you do this for like three or four election cycles, you're going to start having a base of people going against the establishment of the party.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I look at this, and this is a highly encouraging, you know, for those folks out there who got really kind of politically active for the first time during this Bernie Sanders campaign, or actually got re-energized politically, you know, this is an opportunity to go to that website, you know, and I think it's like ourrevolution.com, but if you do Bernie Sanders Our Revolution, it'll come up. And sign up, right? Put your name in the email list and so on, and kind of see if this kind of, you know, makes it. You know, it's also a way of keeping that organization honest, right? To be honest, if we get the most activists who are kind of signing up and kind of got our eyes on this organization, and then start considering, do I want to run for school board? Do I want to run for a kind of local city council? Do I want to run for a kind of state office? This may be that organization that you want to get connected up with now. So, you know, highly optimistic on this one. I have to admit it. I get a bit charged up about this one. So we'll see. So listen, we're coming up to our last break. We're going to come back just a couple minutes, and we're going to close it out for the day. And then I can, you know, get my butt to work painting my house. So, all right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and I'm here with Sean Kitchen. We're going to close things out for the day. Sean, what you got for us?
Nothing much. Just going out today, enjoying a nice little bike ride for a couple hours. Doing like a nice 20-mile ride.
Ah, that's, you know, that's a nice little bike ride.
Yeah, and then I'll be enjoying some beer afterwards.
Enjoying some beer. What kind of beer you got for us?
Pizza Boy had their latest can release last week. Mm-hmm. I was not able to get some until I came back. It's their Marin River IPA. It's one of their best-selling. It's their best-selling beer overall.
Uh-huh.
And I did a pretty large, nice-sized batch of it. And we're selling it in six-pack pounders for $14 a six-pack.
Nice. So let me guess. It's really bad, right?
Oh, it's horrible. I've already went through a six-pack and a half.
Yeah, if anybody goes through, you got to check out Pizza Boy on Facebook or on Twitter, Instagram too, as well as Sean said. The praise for the Marin River stuff is just like off the hook.
Yeah, it is our best selling beer. It really hasn't flown out of here as much as the Sunnyside update or as fast, but it's one of the best IPAs we do, and a lot of people are digging it. When I went into work yesterday, actually, as we opened, and I saw three or four people, two people take out like four cases of beer, you know, because of the state law, you can only take 192 ounces at a time. So they're only able to take a 12 pack at a time, go out. And they did that like five or six times to get a bunch of Marin River and a couple of the other beers we have.
There you go.
So
very cool. Well,
quantities.
There you go. Well, you know, I tried that, you know, you gave me that, you brought me one of those intangible ales from last week. I'm forgetting the name of it right off the top.
Planet Dreamers.
Planet Dreamers, man, that thing was fantastic. Yeah. That thing was absolutely fantastic. So I've got one thing I've got for everybody today is this is like one of my favorite words that I've heard in a long time, and I'm sure this has been a while, been around for a bit, but I haven't heard it until just recently. It's you know, and it fits right in with the whole craft beer scene and the whole beard hipster scene, right? They're talking about you know, the big long hipster beard, right? And referred to that as the lumber sexual beard, as in lumberjack, and I was freaking nearly lost it and fell off my chair. So,
wait, is that the first time you heard that?
That is the first time I've heard it, and I know that
I'm the first.
Huh?
Man, you're like 2 years behind.
Dude, I know, but I'm just I want to express my joy at that word, right? So I'm very happy. And it shows you how far outside the hipster scene or discussions about the hipster scene I actually am. So that's going to do it for today. Everybody, thanks for joining us, Sean. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, I'll talk to you then.
All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This has been Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. We'll be talking to you soon. We're out of here for now. See ya.